How do you like the sound of a bank that's built for you, not the 1%? Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Well, you should check out Chime. Chime isn't just another banking app. They unlock smarter banking for everyday people with products like MyPay, giving you access to up to $500 of your paycheck anytime and getting paid up 2 days early with direct deposit. They also don't charge an overdraft or minimum balance fee, so you're in control of how you spend your money. In fact, there's no monthly fee at all. Instead of charging you to use your own money, Chime actually turns everyday spending into real rewards and progress. It's the new way to build credit history with your own money and get rewarded every single day. Plus, you can earn up to 3% APY on savings, which is 7 times higher than a traditional bank. Several of my mates have already switched to Chime for their everyday spending, and they say that they have never felt more in control of their money. Chime is not just smarter banking, it's the most rewarding way to bank. Join the millions who are already banking fee-free today. It just takes a few minutes to sign up. Head to chime.com/redhanded. That's chime.com/redhanded.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app, with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello, everybody. I know what you all want because you all yelled at me on social media when we released the Delphi update over on Patreon. So here it is. Here is your monthly Patreon wrap-up, focusing almost exclusively, I believe, on the new Delphi information that has come out. Yes, it is time for a Delphi update. Before we get to that, though, I have to tell you something very important. Today, Friday, the 16th of December, 2022, merch pre-orders launched. That is right. If you head on over right now to percivalclo.com, that's percivalclo.com, you will be able to pre-order yourself some brand new beautiful merch that we at Red Handed have developed in collaboration with Percival Clothing. If you know anything about Percival, you will know that they are renowned for their beautiful high quality clothing and their beautiful embroidered designs, and the line they have come up with us at Red Handed is no different. So if you want some brand new beautiful premium embroidered spooky bitch 42nd generation or satanic witch, not in this economy, or maybe some beautiful brand new tarot card designs, then head on over to percivalclo.com right now and use code redhanded10, that's redhanded in all caps and the number 10, for 10% off your first order. So do it. And then listen to the Delphi update.
Right. Very swift U-turn from happy, jolly Christmas chat to Delphi update.
Yeah. Tell me all about it.
It's got to be done. So, guys, Delphi update, strap in. Because since we did our two-parter on the Delphi murders, a lot of weird stuff has happened in this case. Mm-hmm. So, for example, on the 3rd of November, so about exactly almost a month ago, the original judge who was appointed to handle this case, Carroll County Circuit Judge Benjamin Diner, or Diner, I think it's Diner, actually recused himself, said, I don't want to do this fucking case. And he said that the case was too much, it had too much public interest, and he didn't feel like he and his like courthouse, his officials had enough of the resources to deal with all of the public interest. So he was like, I don't want to do this. So the very same day, Judge Frances C. Gull was appointed to take his place. And Judge Frances C. Gull is a very good choice. She's very, very experienced in high profile cases. She knows her shit. So I feel confident that they now have the right judge to handle a case of this magnitude and this complexity and this level of public interest. Then after that, there was, of course, the handwritten letter sent by Richard Allen himself, sent to the courts begging for legal assistance. This was crazy to read because he was basically like, I don't have any legal support. I need you to appoint me public defenders. And people were like, oh my God, why wasn't he given public defenders in the first place? And this is because when he was first arrested, he said, I do not want public defenders. I'm going to find legal representation for myself. And then he realized just how expensive that was going to be, because I think this is a very high profile case. And I was interested when Richard Allen was first arrested to see if any big law firms might take the case pro bono just to have, because it's going to be so high profile. But I think with a double child murder, I think they were like, this isn't really the case we want to attach our names to pro bono. So I think they were like, we'll take it, but you got to pay us. So obviously Richard Allen now being in jail, because when he was first arrested, no bond, no bail. They were like, you're in prison. That's it. And his wife, Kathy, lost her job pretty well. She either lost her job or she didn't feel safe going to work.
Right.
Either way, they don't have any money coming in. So he was like, I need public defense. And he was, after that, appointed two public defenders, Brad Razzie and Andrew Baldwin. So he's fine now. He has public defenders. I mean, he's probably not fine, but he has public defenders. Then on the 22nd of November 2022, there was a hearing in the Delphi case about whether or not the probable cause affidavit, which, if you'll remember from our episode, has been sealed since Richard Allen's arrest, should be made public or not. So if you remember when he was arrested, the probable cause affidavit and the charging documents completely sealed, not even redacted, sealed. We did not see a single thing. This was highly unusual because, like we said, these are public documents and it's not typical. Typically, those things are released. And the probable cause affidavit basically is a document outlining not all of the reasons, but some of the most pressing reasons why the state felt that they had enough on you to arrest you. And I think we can all, as true crime fans, appreciate the importance of transparency on things like that. Like, the state can't just run around arresting people and then keeping it a secret why they've arrested them. That's very like Kafka-esque. Like, people should know. He obviously knew why he had been arrested. His legal defense will have seen the probable cause affidavit, just to make that clear. The public hadn't, but we as the public also have a right to see that information. And also, it's also important that the state has to operate under that kind of public scrutiny, because otherwise, if everything is in the shadows, they can act as sloppily as they want. Things can come out later. Like, it's not a good precedent. Let's just say that. So Richard Allen's defense actually said that they wanted the probable cause affidavit made public.
Right.
They said what is in there is not strong enough evidence to be holding him, and they wanted it made public. Libby and Abby's family, particularly Libby's family, did not want it made public. They even created like a petition to keep it sealed. And obviously the prosecution don't want it released either. So yes, the defense said that there wasn't enough evidence in the sealed documents to warrant Richard Allen being in prison. They said they wanted it made public, and they also wanted Richard Allen released on a reasonable bail that would be affordable, or on his own recognizance, which means no bail at all, but he's allowed out. Not saying that there wouldn't be a trial or further proceedings, but they're saying you should let him go immediately. Now, obviously, the prosecution don't want Richard Allen out, and they also made and they also don't want the probable cause affidavit made public. So they made the case at this hearing that the reasons it shouldn't be made public is because they said it would jeopardize the integrity of their case. And it would put witnesses, particularly those who were at the time or who are still currently minors. And they also said, and this is the most interesting thing, this is also the most interesting thing that they said, the third and final point they made, is that, quote, the prosecutor has good reason to believe that Richard Allen is not the only actor in this heinous crime.
I knew it.
Well, let's come back to that. I'm not saying yes or no. We literally do not know. And like, even with all of the other information that's come out, let's talk about it. So, but before we get there, they said that therefore releasing this probable cause affidavit, unsealing it, would affect this active and ongoing case. It would put it at risk. I found it interesting that they say they have good enough evidence to suspect that somebody was involved, but not good enough evidence to arrest somebody else. And I think that we can't understate how huge it was that the prosecutor, Nick McClelland, actually said this at the official trial hearing, because They are now saying that Richard Allen has an accomplice. They're saying not that we suspect, not that there might be a chance. They said that we have good reason to believe that an accomplice may have been involved. Or no, they don't even say that. There's good reason to believe that another actor was involved, which means that you don't even know if Richard Allen is the accomplice or the killer and the other person is the killer or the accomplice. The reason that this is so big is because this could really bite them in the ass at trial, because all the defense now need to say, all Richard Allen's defense now need to say at trial is, you heard it from the prosecutor himself. There could be another actor here. How do you know that my client is the killer? How do you know he's not just an accomplice? How do you even know that? They don't even seem to know if Richard Allen is the killer or not. And the fact if you cannot at trial, the prosecution, point the finger directly at the accused and say that is the person that killed these girls, and they've messed this up in not just my opinion, the opinions of other people who are in this world, by saying that somebody else could have been involved, and they don't find somebody else before the trial or arrest somebody else, you have now introduced a whole hell of a lot of beyond reasonable doubt as to whether Richard Allen is the killer or the sole killer or an accomplice or nothing. So that is a very odd thing for them to have said, and a big gamble, because like if they don't arrest somebody now, what the fuck, right? So interestingly, that this all happened, the hearing was done, and some people expected there to be an answer straight away, but the judge said, I'm not going to give an answer right now. I'm going to go away and think about this, and I'm going to release a written statement about my decision after Thanksgiving. So we all waited. And it was interesting to see that even Doug Carter, who was, of course, superintendent of Indiana State Police and was the lead investigator on this case, said that he didn't think that there was an issue for those documents to be made public. He actually came out and said that after the hearings. He was like, I think we should just make them public. And I think it's also that when the documents were being hidden, it also sort of created this air of people feeling like, well, the state clearly can't be very confident in their case if they won't release what they have. Mm-hmm. Like, if you have a good case, release it, make it public. Yeah. What are you so worried about? So we all waited. And I think a lot of people, including me, expected the probable cause affidavit and the charging documents to be made public, but redacted versions, because the defense said, we have no problem with you redacting all of the names of the minors in that, and anyone who was a minor, all of the witnesses, if you're worried, because they were saying they're in danger because somebody else who's an accomplice or the other killer on the outside could go get them. Redact all the names. We don't care, but release the document. So that's what we expected to see. And we did indeed see that a couple of days ago, because the probable cause affidavit was indeed released. And like we said, the names of the eyewitnesses are redacted. And the judge actually said that that is not in the public interest to keep this document a secret. So it is now out. What is interesting is that this document makes absolutely no mention of anybody else being involved, not even the hint of anybody else being involved. So it is weird that the prosecution said that as one of their reasons when there is nothing in this document about anybody else. They very much make it seem like Richard Allen was a single actor killer in this. But let's go through it. So the probable cause affidavit document is not very long. It's about 6 pages, but it is very interesting. And it actually goes into a bit more depth about what was on that 43-second video that was shot by Libby on her phone. So it's not a huge amount of detail, and it's probably stuff we could have probably already guessed, and maybe they're still hiding things, but this is what we have. They say that the video from Libby's phone shows Abby on the bridge walking towards her. So she's filming, because you know, we were like, why was she filming Bridge Guy?
So she's filming Abby.
She was filming Abby walking on the bridge. They are standing at the south end of the bridge, as we suspected. Abby is walking towards her, and Bridge Guy is behind her.
Right.
And so I think Libby's like moves the phone to him to look at this man who's in the background and probably moving between the two of them. Then it says, as the man approaches, one of the victims, and they do not specify whether it was Abby or Libby, but I suspect that it was Abby. One of the victims says the word gun. And again, there's probably more to what's being said, but they do not make it clear. Then at the end of the video, the man can be seen and heard telling the girls down the hill. The girls walk down the hill with the man and the video ends. So that's all we have. So it's not a huge amount more than we had before. And I think a lot of people, us included, suspected that he probably had a gun or a knife or something. It says guys, the girls look at him. They're probably like, oh my God, he's got a gun. And then it's down the hill. So it kind of confirms the things that we suspected. After this, no one saw the girls again, because we're going to find out that there were eyewitnesses who saw the girls before, but nobody sees them after this point. And there were no outgoing calls or texts or anything, no outgoing communication from Libby's mobile phone after this video was shot. Now, what's interesting about this is that this is the first official confirmation we have that a gun was present at the scene of the crime. Now, clothes belonging to both of the girls were also found in Deer Creek, which is interesting because up until now, there had been rumors that Libby had been naked and maybe some items of clothing were missing. But this is the first time that I've seen we have official confirmation that clothes had been removed from both of the girls and they were found in the river. Now, this is the bit that's really interesting. A 40 caliber unspent round, so a bullet, was found 2 feet away from Libby's body, in between Libby and Abby's bodies. So it's closer to Libby, but it's in between both of them. 2 feet away. So it's pretty close, right? I'm about 5 feet. So half of me. Very, very close. And this bullet, interestingly, it's unspent, but it had extraction marks on it.
Okay.
So what they were able to conclude is that this bullet was not fired through a gun.
No. But it's been in one.
But it's been in one and it's been cycled through a gun. And it's been ejected. So if you put a bullet in, I don't know much about guns. This is what I have tried to understand. You put the bullet in, you move the cartridge, and then it's been ejected out, but not fired out. Now, they found this bullet. They've obviously had this bullet for a very long time. They didn't just find it now. They've had it since 2017. But it's like a fingerprint, right? A bullet that has markings on from a gun. It's similar to, but not as conclusive, and we're going to go on to that, as a fingerprint. Firstly, it is still only really circumstantial evidence, and unless you can absolutely confirm it came out of a gun, and you really can't do that. So the way it's circumstantial is, although it's a physical piece of evidence, is that it's found there, but you now have to prove that it came out of a specific gun linked to a specific person. You can only do that within, it's like hair comparison, you can say it's similar. It's not as weak, and we will go on to this. But then you also have to show that that bullet came to be there during the commission of that crime and wasn't just in the woods from another day, right? Because it's like a fingerprint. You find a fingerprint at the scene of the crime, but you have to prove that that fingerprint was left there during the commission of the crime, not by somebody who was there another time. So they had the bullet, but they needed a specific gun to be able to match it to. So yes, no idea of whether it was linked to the girls' murders, but it likely seemed that it was. We still do not know if the girls were shot. So again, was the bullet just there? Was the gun used to threaten them? But were they killed in some other way? If the bullet was found inside them, then you know that it's used in the commission of the crime. But that wasn't the case. It's just found next to them and it wasn't even shot. So we'll come back to the gun. But for now, let's talk about the multiple eyewitnesses who saw Bridge Guy on the 13th of February, 2017. Prior to this probable cause affidavit being released, I had seen mention of two sets of witnesses who had seen him. None of them had been named. One of them was definitely minors. The other weren't, but they were in their very early 20s and they weren't named anyway. So like I said, all of the names have been redacted. So I'm not just not using their names for no reason other than that. So one of the group of people who saw them was the group that I was originally aware of. It's a group of teenage girls who saw, and one in particular, she's the one who gave the original Bridge Guy eyewitness sketch. So she said that she saw a man walking from Freedom Bridge to the Monon High Bridge. So there are two bridges on this trail and they're about 3 miles apart. She said her and her friends were on Freedom Bridge. They saw the man there and he was walking towards Monon High Bridge. This man matched Bridge Guy's description. And what's important is that she gave this description of Bridge Guy, what he was wearing, the blue jacket, the blue jeans, the hoodie, etc. She gave that description before the video and the still image from Libby's phone was released. So it's very likely that who she did see is probably Bridge Guy, unless there was another man running around dressed the exact same. But we're also going to go on to find out that all of the witnesses who saw this man, probably all saw the same man, said that they did not see another adult male on the trails that day. So she says that this man glared at her, glared at all of them. Which is why, if you remember in our episodes, we said that there was a witness who saw him and he scared her. She said that he wasn't very tall, no taller than 5'10", that he was a bit of a bigger build, and he had something covering his mouth, like a scarf or a hoodie or something that was pulled up. Like he was making a conscious effort not
to conceal his
His face. Now, another witness who I had not seen this before says that she saw Bridge Guy on the Monon High Bridge itself on the day of the murders. So this woman says, and she's not a minor, she's a bit older. She said that she parked her car at a nearby farm shop and she walked onto the trails. She then said she came to the Monon High Bridge, and when she looked at the bridge, she saw a man matching Bridge Guy's description and matching the description given by the girls on Freedom Bridge standing on the first platform of the bridge. So the bridge is like over 1,000 feet long. And at various points, there are platforms that step off the bridge. Like, they're not very big, like little, a few planks that allow you to get off the bridge, that would allow you to like let other people pass, right, for example. And he was standing on the first bridge, so for the first platform. So not too far off from where she was standing. And she says she saw him, but she didn't get onto the trail. She didn't get onto the bridge. She saw him and then she carried on the trail. And she said that as she walked off the past the bridge and onto the trail, she walked past two girls that were most likely Abby and Libby. She identifies them as the victims, walking towards the Monon High Bridge.
So he's already on the bridge.
Okay. So this again starts to throw up some questions, because we know that the girls get onto the bridge, they walk all the way to the south.
And then he's behind them.
He's waiting to see who gets onto this bridge.
Right.
Now, the question is that a lot of people are throwing up. If his aim was just to get some girls, why didn't he go after the teenage girls he saw at Freedom Bridge? Firstly, there are more of them and they're older. The girl who gives the eyewitness testimony, from what I remember seeing, she's 16 years old and she's there with more than one person. Abby and Libby, they're 13, 14. That is a huge difference between 13 and 16, 14 and 16 even. Oh my God, yeah. They are so
vulnerable. I mean, the
difference
between a year 7 and a year 11 is terrifying.
It is gargantuan, that leap between those two ages. It is not going to have been as easy for him to do anything to those girls on Freedom Bridge. So I think he was waiting on Monon High Bridge and laying in wait to see who comes. Now it throws up the whole question of, did he know the girls were coming? Did he not? We can't answer that. It would just be speculation. So I don't know. So he's already on the bridge. And I suspect, again, this is speculation, does he see the girls coming? He gets off the bridge. He lets them pass. They walk to the other end of the bridge. They're taking videos of themselves. He gets back on the bridge and starts walking. And that's why Libby starts filming him, because she's like, wasn't that guy who was probably being a bit, probably scared them a bit when they encountered him at the end? Or did he just immediately hide? They never saw him. We don't know. But this woman who saw him and saw the girls places Bridge Guy on the bridge. She doesn't say it's Richard Allen. This is the infuriating thing about all of these witnesses that we're going to talk about. All of them describe a very, very similar man, wearing a blue jacket, blue jeans, etc. Always got his head down, always got his hands in his pockets, always making an effort to conceal his face. They all seem to have seen the same person, but none of them say it's Richard Allen because he was hiding his face the entire time. So all we can say is, does he look like Bridge Guy? Yes, but probably so do a lot of people. So anyway, let's carry on. So she sees Abby and Libby walking towards the Monon High Bridge. This woman also saw a vehicle parked in a, quote, weird way by the old CPS building. Also something that we talked about in our episode. If you remember, Doug Carter and the investigators said there was a car, or a vehicle, actually. They said a vehicle parked at the old CPS building, abandoned CPS building. We would like information from the driver who was parked there. But they never released the make or the model or the color or anything. Right. Because remember us being like, that's weird. Why would you say that? Who are you actually talking to? Now, another witness also saw this vehicle and said it was a purple PT Cruiser. Now, I don't know.
Oh, Christ.
Yes. Now, I don't know a lot about cars. Hannah, I'm guessing from your reaction, you know what a PT Cruiser is.
I know exactly what a PT Cruiser is. They look like a hearse.
Yes, yes. It's a weird looking car. It looks like the front of a truck, but squashed down.
That's exactly what a PT Cruiser is.
Into a car.
Hideous cars.
And apparently it was purple.
It's the worst one.
Yeah. So this witness also said, I saw this car, was a purple PT Cruiser, and it was parked in a weird way. Now, this is very much speculation. This person says that the car looked like it was parked in a way so that you couldn't see the license plate. I don't know how that happens. I don't really know what they mean
by
that.
Well, as we know from our jaunt in Ohio, so many American cars don't even fucking have license plates.
This is true.
What the fuck is that about America?
I have no idea.
I've never seen it anywhere. But when we were in Ohio, I was like, how do we know which Uber is ours? Because none of these cars have fucking license plates on them.
It's the weirdest thing I've ever seen. They have got, like, they, I think they had it on the back, but none of them had it on the front. It was crazy. So anyway.
So yeah, if it was just a tiny sticker on the back, then maybe actually, I'll take do you know my what? Spawn away. Yeah.
I was confused because I was like, they said it was backed into the building so that you couldn't see the back, so you couldn't see the license plate. I was like, but what about the one on the front? So maybe there wasn't one on the front.
Yeah, maybe. And also, but also if you're driving a purple PT Cruiser, not many people have that car.
No, I know. You know. It's a weird car. So this person says that that's what it is. It's very, very specific. I don't know. I don't know what's going on with that. But we do know that both of the witnesses who saw this car outside the old CPS building drew diagrams of where the car was parked and how it was parked. And these descriptions matched. So most likely they did see the same vehicle. Now, the woman who saw it didn't describe it as a purple PT Cruiser. She just said it was like a dark car. So so confused, but eyewitnesses are fucking shit anyway. Yeah. Eyewitnesses, no offense to all these eyewitnesses, they did see something and they probably all did see Bridge Guy, and these two probably did see the car, but eyewitness testimony is not the best.
Fallible. Right? Yeah.
It's very fallible. So another witness saw Bridge Guy. This is very interesting. Saw Bridge Guy walking, and again, give very, and I'm calling them all Bridge Guy because they all describe the same person. Or someone very similar, walking away from the Monon High Bridge down the CR300 road north. I don't know what this road is, but it's a public fucking road that this person saw, was driving down the road and saw him, and described him as being muddy and bloody. Yes. Wow. And the timing of this would have been after the murders. Now, this person figured that he'd been in a fight, and that's why they remember it. They remember this guy covered in mud and covered in blood. And it was just after 4 p.m. So it would have been ample time for him to have murdered the girls and get to that road.
So he probably did shoot them then.
Very possibly. And it matches the description that the FBI said that this person, whoever committed this crime, there was so much blood lost at the scene of the crime. Whoever shot this person, whoever killed the girls, sorry, would have been covered in their blood. Let's come back to the gun and etc. in a second. For now, question, why is he walking so publicly on a public road, so openly? Was he returning to his vehicle? If he was, it does seem like he was walking in the direction of the old CPS building. That could have been his car. Now, this all just points to the finger. Let me start again.
You're all over with your metaphors today.
All of these eyewitnesses all only point to the idea that they all saw Bridge Guy. They all match Bridge Guy's description. They all saw a man who seemed to be exhibiting similar sorts of behavior, i.e. being rude, hands in his pockets, covering his face, dressed the same, etc. And the only male, the only adult male that all of these witnesses who spent hours on that trail that day saw. This is the only person. But was it Richard Allen? That's the question. Well, the probable cause affidavit that has been published confirms that Richard Allen was interviewed by the police in 2017. Now, before everyone gets very excited about this, basically all of the men in Delphi were questioned by the police. Were questioned by the police in 2017. And Richard Allen actually came forward of his own accord. He came to the police and he said, I want to clear things up. I was on the trails that day. And this is the thing. He admitted to the police in 2017 that he was on the trails that day. Now, again, eyewitness testimony isn't everything, and the trails do cover a large area, but all of the witnesses said only adult male I saw that day. Maybe Richard Allen didn't know that when he came forward and admitted to being on the trails that day. He says that he arrived at 1:30 and left at 3:30, which again places him there at the exact time and in the exact location during the time that the girls were murdered. He even admits to having seen the girls on Freedom Bridge, who saw him, or saw Bridge Guy. And he admits to having gone onto the Monon High Bridge to look at the fish. The bridge is quite high up. I don't know how you're seeing fish in the river.
Maybe they're like those like radiation catfish that are the size of fucking buses.
Maybe. So that is quite interesting. And then he says that he sat on a bench for a bit by the bridge, and then he didn't see anybody else, and then he went home. That's his story. My issue is the witnesses saw no other adult male, and all of the witnesses give a description that is strikingly similar to each other. So all of them saw the same man. And he admits that he saw the girls on the Freedom Bridge and had an interaction with them.
Mm-hmm.
So if the girls on the Freedom Bridge saw him and all of the witnesses describe the same man and he's the only adult male there, then it stands to reason that he is the one that everybody saw and therefore he is Bridge Guy.
Right.
But he places himself there and he places himself with the girls on Freedom Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And at the exact same fucking time and in the same location, literally he says, I was on the Monon High Bridge. Mm-hmm. I feel like, is he saying this because he's worried that somebody saw him? Because they did. They just don't know it was him.
Right.
And is he just doing it to cover himself because he doesn't want to get caught in a lie later? So is the most obvious thing to hide in plain sight, like he literally did. I was there, but I didn't do it.
Yeah.
And I didn't see anybody else. I've got nothing to hide.
If I had something to hide, why would I tell you I was there?
Exactly. It's almost like calling their bluff, right? It's not saying I was never there. And then they later find out that he was there because he doesn't know what he's left behind. He doesn't know who's seen him.
Yeah.
So he's like, yeah, I was there, but I didn't do this. So interesting. Right. So what else do we have? So it doesn't seem that the police in 2017, when they interviewed him, thought that he was a suspect. They interviewed him. They let him go. It was a pretty standard conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how they came back to Richard Allen in 2022 is very unclear.
Right.
We do not know how they went from the 2017 interview through all of the shit with the fucking Kleins and all of that chaos, how they came back to Richard Allen. We still don't have that answer. There has been some reports that I've seen that they've said that they circled back and relooked at old tips and interviews with him. And this does happen. You go back and look at old interviews and you realize that you missed something or some new information that you found out now makes something else that you learned in 2017 more relevant. Mm-hmm. But we don't know. It's very, very vague. Very, very vague.
Mm-hmm.
Did Kegan Klein point the finger at Richard Allen? There's no mention of that in the probable cause affidavit whatsoever. So I'm not going to speculate on that. So cars. What car was Richard Allen driving that day? Because he says he was at the trails and CCTV proves it because he drove down the Hoosier Highway mm-hmm. and he was caught on CCTV. And in 2017, he had two cars. Neither of them was a purple PT Cruiser
right.
because if they were, that would be very fucking handy.
Right, yeah, yeah.
What he did have, though, was one of them was a black Ford Focus.
Okay.
And the CCTV from that day confirms that this is the one he was driving when he went to the trails, as he himself admitted. It was caught on CCTV heading towards the old CPS building at about 1:30. So was this the car that was parked outside the old CPS building? But how you confuse a black Ford Focus with a purple PT Cruiser, I don't know.
Very different cars.
But again, eyewitness testimony, it's something or nothing, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, all of this stuff with the cars. Then the probable cause affidavit confirms that Richard Allen was then interviewed again for a second time on the 13th of October, 2022. So this year. And again, he confirmed, and we don't know why they came back to this interview, but as in went back to interview him, but he was. And he again confirmed, I was on the trail that day. I saw the girls on Freedom Bridge. They saw me. I went to Monon High Bridge and I saw no one else there. I parked my car on the side of an old building.
Mm-hmm.
Vague. And he also admits in this 2022 interview to be wearing a very similar outfit to what Bridge Guy was wearing that day. He says he was wearing a blue Carhartt jacket and jeans. And he said that he saw no one else that day. But that's so he places himself there
mm-hmm.
at the exact time, in the exact place, wearing the same fucking clothes as Bridge Guy. But again, it's because he knows he can't deny it
yeah.
because those girls on Freedom Bridge saw him and he admits to seeing them. So that same day, so the 13th of October, 2022, the police searched Richard Allen's house.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first time. And they recovered jackets, boots, knives, and firearms, including a Sig Sauer model P226. Now, the next day, on the 14th of October, the next week, all of this stuff goes to the forensics lab where it's analyzed. In particular, they focus on the Sig Sauer model P226 because they have a bullet that they mm-hmm. need to compare. Now, to compare the extraction marks on the bullet that was found, obviously they needed a gun all along and now they have one. So the forensic analysts who are working this gun and this bullet came to the conclusion after looking at the bullet and Richard Allen's gun that although the bullet had not been fired, they said that their tests showed that this projectile, the bullet that they found at the crime scene, had been cycled through Richard Allen's weapon.
Mm-hmm.
They are saying this. So basically, Anyone who's watched CSI, you don't need me to tell you this, but when a gun is fired, the bullet blasts down the barrel and it encounters ridges and grooves in the barrel of the gun that cause it to spin to increase the accuracy of the shot. Those ridges and grooves are there for a purpose. But these ridges and grooves dig into the soft metal of the bullet and they leave striation, they leave marks, they leave dents. Now, at the same time, and I got this from a forensics, official forensics government website, it says at the same time that the bullet explodes forward, the cartridge case explodes backwards with equal force against the mechanism that absorbs the recoil, causing the breech face. This stamps an impression onto the breech face into the soft metal at the base of the cartridge case, which is then ejected from the gun. So the theory behind firearm identification is that microscopic striations and impressions left on the bullet and the cartridge are unique and reproducible. So if you get another bullet, put it in that gun and shoot it again, they should match. And therefore, they say it's like a ballistics fingerprint and it can be used to identify a specific gun. If obviously they find bullets or cartridges at the scene of the crime. But the problem is that bullets and cartridges fired from different guns might have similar markings that are statistically significantly similar enough through observation, especially if the guns were manufactured consecutively, which I thought was interesting. So this raises the possibility of false positive matches, right? This is not a hard and fast rule. This is not DNA. This is not even a fingerprint, even though they call it a ballistics fingerprint, which I think can be quite misleading. This is subjective. This is down to an analyst looking at two bullets, one that they fired through this gun, one that they found at the scene, and comparing the two to see if they are statistically, significantly statistically similar enough to say that that is a match. So it's not 100%. And that's let alone if the bullet is fired through the gun. In this case, the bullet wasn't even fired through the gun. It was only cycled through the gun. So I don't know how that makes a difference, but it feels like that makes it even less 100% of a match. So yes, they themselves have admitted in the forensics report, this is subjective in nature. This match is subjective in nature.
Right.
Which is probably not strong enough evidence to secure a conviction. They're going to need circumstantial evidence to back this up. Like they are going to need a whole hearty case. I'm not saying everything in the probable cause affidavit is everything that the prosecution have. That would be crazy and it'd be very unlikely. They will have more, but this is what we now know.
You may remember deep in your mind cave, we once told you about a podcast, wasn't once, it was last year, called Wisecrack from our good old buddy old pals over at Tenderfoot. Wisecrack is a really unique blend of stand-up comedy set and a shocking true crime case. Basically, a comedian describes the night he found himself at the centre of a double murder. Wisecrack has gone on to make Apple's best podcasts list, and that's full of people like us, so you know it's true. And it's nominated for iHeart and Ambie Awards this year. And it was The Guardian's podcast of the year, top tier, number one, top spot. And now Wisecrack is heading on a true crime slash comedy tour with comedian Ed Hedges performing his stand-up set live. And it's in a city that is maybe, very possibly, near you. Wisecrack's tour will hit Dublin and Manchester as well as London on Valentine's Day. And then it will head into the US for February and March. For dates and ticket info, visit wisecracklive.com. That's wisecracklive.com and search Wisecrack in your podcast app to listen to the show and see what all the noise and hype is about, my friend.